queen of calumny, Rosemary McLeod, back on the panel, an expert, as we know, on textiles, also in all things bright and beautiful thereon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
With her is Steve McCabe, Auckland school teacher, speaker of Japanese, a commercial pilot. Well, he has a license. He's a multi-talented man. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And what's new in your life, please, Steve?
Well, let's see. I guess this is what comes with the territory of being the father of a teenage girl, but I was down the pictures on Friday night, went to see the Hunger Games.
Oh, yes, we're going to review it tomorrow, on Friday.
It's not bad. My daughter will kill me for saying that. Apparently it's the finest film ever made, last word in brilliant cinematography, hanging off the edge of seat stuff, according to her. I was reasonably impressed. It's decent. I think what really pleased me, actually, was the fact that I now live in a town where I can just walk down to the cinema on Friday evening.
Well, wasn't it like that back home in the old days?
Back home in the old days, that's the thing, yeah. I mean, I left England in 91, and my local cinema had been pulled down for 15 years at that point. You know, it's...
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, the old flea pit down the road, it was turned into an old folks' home.
So were there, multiplexes somewhere else?
There was indeed. We had the great big thing 10 miles down the road in Salford, down at Salford Quays, and you could go and watch your great big... big, enormous blockbusters at the big, enormous screen. Yeah. But the place that you could walk to on a Saturday morning for a bit of fun was long gone. So it's fantastic to see that coming back in Pukekohe.
Oh, you'd be pleased. So Pukekohe is the place for you.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It's a funny controversy about the Hunger Games with the African... Is she African-American actress in it, the young woman? And this bizarre controversy in America, which we will just probably discuss on Friday, actually.
But... Well, everything in America ultimately boils down to race. It's one of the most fantastically racially charged and segregated countries, even though they'll never admit it. And there are two characters, two sort of incidental characters, who are kind of not really explicitly, but sort of hinted at to be black in the book that the film's based on. In the film, suddenly it becomes thrown into very, very stark relief that the one guy saves the one girl because she's black. Black people take care of black people and they'd kill white people otherwise is very, very clear undertext. And that's the sense that you end up with living in America after a while, is everything is about race.
They're described in the book, two characters, as one brown-skinned, one black-skinned, unquote, though, aren't they? There is a clear...
Oh, there's passing references,
yeah.
And again, it matters. And it's also marked. I mean, nobody else in the book has their skin colour commented on. If it's not mentioned, the default colour is obviously white. But you have to mention it. It's a significant thing. Black people are marked in American culture.
How are your bees? Because that's the other thing you do. You're a beekeeper, aren't you? I discovered today.
Yes, that's a little hobby that my wife Debbie and I have been taking part in for about a year and a half now. We keep bees out in the back garden. And we've been harvesting them recently, but we're not terribly pleased at the moment because we've just discovered that Auckland City Council now see bees not as a source of honey, but as a source of revenue.
Oh, how come?
Well, they just... they've buried this deep. It's about page 140-some somewhere in the Auckland City draft long-term plan. They suddenly said, consent fee for the keeping of bees, $190. and those of us in the beekeeping community are scratching our heads going, now, what do we get from this again? And no one's been quite clear, except for the fact that, you know, you've got Mayor Brown making... I've got a couple of quotes from him here. We do not want to discourage beekeepers in the city, and we are struggling for beehives and for bee populations. Oh, yeah, and that'll be $190. Thank you very much. So we're not impressed with this, obviously. We'll get no benefit from it other than a receipt.
So you've never had to pay anything before?
Well, no, that's not entirely true. Every beekeeper in the country pays a small charge of around $30 a year to register their hives.
Right.
And for that, we get kept informed about possible pest spreads. We get kept up to date on pest control and management. And it's actually quite a useful thing to do.
Okay. Maybe they'll start coming and checking your hives for you now.
We already do that. Already getting checked regularly. Like I say, no benefit. I will not be sending Len any honey for Christmas.
Rosemary McLeod, you must be living a quiet life at the moment because it says here, has been watching TV.
Yeah, but only... Well, this is the thing. TV is so... I don't know. I'm going to say it. It's so disappointing. And I mean, like a number of people I know, I've just sort of taken to buying TV series online that I really enjoy watching and that would never be screened here. I mean, all right, we all talked about The Wire, right? We all got totally hooked on that. It was fabulous. Since then, I've been watching the Danish two series now called The Killing. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
It's fantastic. It has the most, you know, on the edge of your seat sort of ends of every episode. Cliffhangers, we call them, don't we?
Yes.
And you sort of sit there and think, no, no, I've got to watch the next one. So that's brilliant. Subtitles, of course.
Are you managing to learn much Danish from it?
Well, no, but you see, I've also been watching this French one called The Spiral or Engrenage, and that is fantastic. That's another cop show full of all sorts of gory stuff. The delicious thing about Engrenage is you have this opening imagery of this hideously dismembered female, and everybody's going, oh God, I want to be sick in a bucket. Everything that's been done to this woman is so disgusting, and so on. But then the sort of cops swan in and they say things like, ah, she must have been beautiful. Yes. They would not have mutilated her if she were not beautiful. A high point in cultural television.
Yes.
Also, you do have that thrill where every now and then you understand something they're saying, like bonjour, and yeah, you feel really educated.
Yeah, that's right. You feel international.
Yeah.
So do you watch this on your computer or do you watch it on the big
screen? Oh, on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great fun. And the one I've just started watching, we finished it, was a shorter series, is The Hour. I don't know if you've seen that. That's sort of based on a fictional BBC in the 1950s.
No.
And it's jolly good. It's better than anything I see on regular TV.
I wish people wouldn't ask me, as they regularly do, whether I've seen a show on television, because I invariably haven't.
No, I haven't either.
Did you go to the Colonial and Collectibles auction at Dunbar's?
Well, you see, that's the terrible thing. I'm actually in the group of post-auction Triest.
Oh, you did?
I should know better. Because every time I go, you know, I think I know what I'm going to do. I'm very disciplined. I'm only going to bid on this and that. So then you bid far too much on this and that, and then you see all this other stuff going for, oh, gosh, it's not going for very much. Suddenly you've got an enormous bill and a whole pile of things that you can't imagine what you were thinking.
What did you buy?
Well, textile-y things, but mostly, except for a lovely Art Deco brooch pin thing. But a daggy thing I bought was Christmas crackers from the 1950s, and my daughter, adult daughter, immediately said, oh, we've got to pull one. So we pulled one. There was the most horrendous crash. It was like a pistol shot. We both fell back in shock, and my hand seemed to be in pain from whatever it was that caused this combustible thing to happen.
God.
It was somewhat hilarious. Little did we realise what fun we were having in the 50s when, you know, nobody was worried about whether we were going to get hurt or not.
There was a half a ton of gunpowder in the Christmas cracker.
I tell you, it was incredible. I would hesitate to pull the next one. Really was fun.
Was there anything good inside it?
Little plastic hearts and little plastic animals that you can, I suppose if you were a kid, you'd hang on a thread around your neck and feel terribly sophisticated.
Yeah.
Yeah, and bad jokes. Only in this case, the bad jokes were all in Dutch for some reason.
Were they?
Yeah.
You have to learn that as well as Danish. I think Christmas cracker prices have actually improved, though, haven't they? I mean, the experience may be more tame these days, but I think what's inside a cracker is better than then.
Oh, yeah, but what I don't like is that you pick it up, you look at the back, and they tell you what you're going to get in there.
The whole point
about them was that you didn't know what you were going to get.
No.
And now you look at those crappy little bits of plastic and you think, nah, I don't want to pay $20 for that.
Nah, says Rosemary McCabe.
Yeah, nah, I say.
Steve McCabe with her on the panel. The Green Party says a police upgrade to double-shot tasers is a slippery slope towards greater frontline firepower. The police are planning to replace their tasers with a new model capable of firing two charges without the need for reloading. This is the new X2. Works pretty much the same as the current X26. Fires the two small prongs that attach to a target. Comes with a ready-to-fire second cartridge. David Clendon from the Greens, their police spokesperson, says the party's concerned with the likelihood of the tasers being used more routinely rather than as a weapon of last resort. The party will be challenging the police to explain why they need the upgrade. What do you think of the police upgrading tasers? Sensible or another road? Another
road to perdition?
Well, something like that.
I'm not as worried as David Clendon. I don't see why they shouldn't be upgraded, and I don't see why upgrading them would mean they were used more often, if that is the inference that's been drawn from this. I mean, if they have a need, look, put it this way, I'd rather they use tasers than guns. And, you know, so if they want better tasers, have better tasers, but just don't shoot people.
Yeah. One of the part of the reason they're doing this is because tasers are so problematic. in terms of whether they deliver the jolt required, latch on properly, etc. And I think there are longer prongs on them now for that reason. But this is going to double their chances, presumably, of success. Do you see it as sensible too?
My very first thought was I want one for my classroom.
Yes, but it was a thought that's quickly exited, I'm sure.
Well, unfortunately, I checked and they won't let me. But, yes. I mean, there's a few thoughts that come to mind here. You know, one consideration is these things are routinely lethal. They're certainly, for many people, close to lethal. They deliver a hell of a blow. A second shot is likely to then turn this thing into a routinely lethal weapon, isn't it?
I don't know if that's true. Presumably the second shot would only be used if the first shot failed. They're not going to give them both barrels.
That's right. It's not necessarily a 1-2.
Who's going to judge?
Well, this is the thing, I suppose.
He fell down, but he's still moving.
I really feel uncomfortable about this sort of topic in a way, because after something happens that we're all very upset about, we all second-guess a series of decisions that were made. And none of us would really like to have to make those decisions. I don't want to be an apologist for the police automatically, but I also know how awful people are and can be under the influence of pee and other crazy drugs. And what on earth are you supposed to do? I mean, I wish we were like the Phantom and they could just bash them with a special ring on their finger that left the mark of a skull and they collapsed like they do in the comics, but they don't seem to.
I know. Look, whenever we talk about a topic like this, we get texts saying, listen, you aren't there. What do you know? You're just armchair critics. But we have a keen interest, don't we, in knowing about police methodology to make sure that they're doing it right and with the right results. And that's fair enough, isn't it?
That's absolutely fair enough. So we should. They have to be scrutinised all the time. But I do think, you know, not to be too pathetic about it, there is tremendous pressure on those people at such times. And quite often, I mean, people are scary when they're off their head. On drugs or insanity, and we've seen plenty of evidence of what they're capable of.
I mean, one thing I'd like to see here is what sort of guidelines police officers who are issued these things are going to be working under. I mean, this is clearly an offensive, not a defensive weapon. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the police would probably disagree with you thoroughly, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they'd say they wouldn't use it unless people were, you know, in danger, i.e. themselves.
We have to assume that's the case. Can we be absolutely 100% certain that this will never be used, for example, to stop somebody who's trying to flee from an arrest?
Well, then there's a hue and cry, and it's perfectly easy to establish, isn't it?
You're talking about taser creep, aren't you, which the Greens are concerned about and a number of other people.
Never actually heard that language for it, but yes, apparently I am. That's basically where we're headed with this is, okay, first of all, if you're rampaging on all manner of drugs and you're hopped up on Lord knows what, and you're about to jump on top of me, yeah, it's going to be a valuable weapon for me. Next stage is, I think, well, you're about to jump on top of me. I'll use it then. Well, you look like you could well be hopped up on something, then I better use it. Well, now you are. Well, I needed to arrest you anyway. Where do we go next? I mean, it is creeping, and it's a danger.
Where you go next, and I'm surprised New Zealand police haven't been talking about it, is what British police use, which you may be aware of. You know, Raoul Moat, who was cornered, he was shot with the Taser XREP, which is deployed from a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun and can shoot the barbs up to 100 feet away, less in a wind, I imagine. But you can stand off more and use a long-distance Taser. Would that solve some of that problem for you or not?
No, in that case, it actually amplifies my concern. In that case, it's most assuredly an offensive weapon, because if you're shooting at somebody 100 feet away, you are not in imminent danger.
Are you one of those people who think that, you know, as you progressively arm the police with fancier technology, you encounter a progressive deterioration in the behaviour of criminals?
Well, one of those people is such a loaded way of describing it, really, isn't it? But no, not necessarily. I mean, certainly, generally speaking, what we tend to see is calls for this kind of move, calls for increasing arming of police, generally as a response to a more violent society, as opposed to the other way around. I think we're getting cause and effect back to front there. But it is indicative, clearly, of a generally more violent society.
Yeah.
And that can never be a good thing in general.
Professor Greg Newbold on the panel yesterday told us that even as crime stats reduce, nasty crime stats increase, for example, aggravated assaults. So the police arm themselves accordingly to deal with those kinds of situations.
And they do get killed, don't forget. I mean, we've had a series of people getting, you know, ordinary people being shot and killed by police, but it doesn't help when a number of police have been shot and killed. I mean, I look back to some sort of golden era when this would have been freakishly abnormal, but it's not anymore.
Just before we hear from Mike Williams, who's our first guest today, let's also talk briefly about this sad shooting in Hawke's Bay. The officer in charge of the investigation into this fatal police shooting has admitted it is possible that the victim was shot twice and possibly more, which is what the family are wondering about and demanding answers concerning. This is 19-year-old Lachlan Kelly Tumarai, shot after police said he fired a shotgun in Fern Hill, about 18k southwest of Napier. His family had the clothes returned with what seemed to them to be 13 bullet holes, 7 in his trousers, 5 in his shirt, 1 in his shoe. The police are denying this, and they're saying the family's getting mixed up with tears in the clothing, etc. But do you wonder how the official recollection of a police shooting can be, at first we fired one shot, and then the evidence seems to put the number of shots, and that's shots landed, not fired, as higher?
What I don't understand, the first thing I don't understand, is that somebody was shot, this young guy was shot. I would have thought that you would get in there immediately and do a forensic investigation just as you would automatically for a crime, and that therefore we would have eventually proper, sensible answers to this question, which kind of surprises me that the clothing were returned so swiftly. I mean, it's the obvious thing. They've seen holes in the clothing. I saw this on television last night, and they're asking the questions that you would expect. And when on earth, when do they get a proper, trustworthy answer to their concerns? You know, this slightly worries me.
Detective Superintendent Andy Lovelock wouldn't say how many times the officer who killed Mr. Tumarai fired his Glock, quote, because that's a matter we need to keep for later in the investigation. So you're saying why? Why take refuge, what, in procedure this way?
Well, isn't it worrying? I mean, we should be reassured when the family raises this concern, and let's face it, this kid is dead. That's dreadful. Somehow, I would like to know clearly what the procedure is whereby we know we're going to reach a trustworthy conclusion about what really happened, i.e., yes, we've seen those holes, we've had them tested by proper scientists who specialise in this, we're going to be able to give you a really good answer on that. But this is the sort of reassurance we're not getting.
I'm going to have to jump in here. There's a couple of things. I mean, Jim, you mentioned that they're saying that they're going to save the information about the number of bullets fired until later in the investigation. Why? Have they not decided how many they're going to announce yet? I mean, a number's a number. Why are they saving the number? That sounds like they haven't quite decided what to admit to yet. That's very dodgy. The other thing is, they say they've returned the clothes. That's fine. Where's the body? If you want to know how many bullets went in, I mean, I'm not an expert on these things, but I'm guessing that a shot that goes through clothing is likely to penetrate the body as well. Count the bullet holes in the body.
Well, they refer, I can't find the right quote from Andy Lovelock, but they refer to a shot that hit Lachlan in the abdomen, and that is the only one that is linked to a bullet penetration.
Well, that's got to be the definitive answer, surely.
I suppose so. So you wonder why there is such confusion.
Well, you do wonder when Mr. Lovelock himself appears to have difficulty counting.
Well, at first, certainly, there was only one at first, and then it has risen in number, but the number we do not know. Thank you both. 26 minutes past 4. Now, after a chaotic day of refusals and climb downs, Downing Street has eventually bowed to pressure and disclosed details of the British Prime Minister's private contact with the multi-millionaires who fund his party. And the disclosures followed the resignation of Peter Cruddas as Conservative co-treasurer. He was recorded claiming that for £250,000, party donors could gain privileged access to the Prime Minister and potentially influence government policy, which has been frantically denied. What a schmozzle this has turned out to be in the UK.
And what seedy footage that was. It gave you a really bad feeling, didn't it, as he outlined the joys that you could achieve with your £250,000. It's absolutely gross. I can't understand why people aren't calling for his resignation vigorously.
It makes one so proud to be British.
Is it an abdication of ethics doing this, having the dinner party with all the wealthy people at it? Or is it merely sensible that you pay money and the PM expresses his profound gratitude?
It's repulsive. I mean, everybody's vote is equal. And, you know, your vote shouldn't be £250,000 more equal than anybody else's. I mean, it may be a bit naive to think that wealthy people won't influence a Conservative government, but for heaven's sake, I mean, this is so blatant and so explicit. It reminds you of dear old Fergie, doesn't it? When you were going to get to the royal family too, all it took was pay my charge account at Harrods or whatever.
And is the money in that suitcase?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is very, very embarrassing for the British. It really is. I mean, it's a mess. Why else would you pay that kind of sum to have dinner with David Cameron? It can't be for his company and his companionship, surely. You're doing this because you want to influence policy, surely.
Well, you'd get a thrill. I mean, you'd be able to take the wife or the husband and you'd be able to get a photo. I mean, it would be something to say, I was invited to Chequers to dine with the PM.
Yes, and there he was schmoozing with the Murdoch people too, you know, don't forget.
Yeah, because it's quality company to keep, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Do you get to borrow a horse as well?
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
Does a horse come with it? Former Labour Party President Mike Williams kindly joining the panel on this. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How seriously do you regard this yourself in terms of...
It's another country and another culture, but you couldn't get away with it here. Mind you, I'd have to say that I think New Zealand has amongst the cleanest politics on earth. I can kind of recognise what happened, but it's quite clear that Crudas overstepped the mark. There's no doubt that there are people who want to rub shoulders with the leader, and that they just aren't rich people. And, you know, I spent 11 years as campaign manager for the Labor Party and 9 as president, and I was fundraising in both roles. And people do want to, you know, have their photo with the leader. Helen certainly never charged for that. I mean, if you're at a South Auckland Samoan picnic and people wanted a photo with her, then that was fine. Have a photo with her. But, and I don't think there never have been fundraising dinners, in my knowledge, at Premier House or at Helen's home in Mount Eden. Mind you, not that you could fit many people in to Helen's home in Mount Eden. So I think that what seems to have overstepped the mark here is the offer to influence policy, Jim.
Yes, but of course that's being denied, and of course David Cameron saying it never happened. My goodness, no. So let's assume that policy was not affected. Is it a crime showing your gratitude to the people who've given your campaign so much money, Mike?
It may not be a crime, but it's a dumb thing to do. Helen Clark... I raised millions of dollars over many years for the Labor Party, but Helen Clark never knew who the big donors were, apart from the fact when they outed themselves in public. She knew Owen Glenn had given us $500,000 because he had announced to the world he had. But most of the people who gave us, and the sort of numbers that you're seeing in the press, you know, to be honest with you, is enough to make you slather. I never saw numbers like that. I considered myself lucky if I walked out with $5,000 or $10,000. But certainly she didn't know about that, and she made that explicit to me when I started fundraising, that she did not want to know who was giving us money.
Do you think it goes on in any New Zealand political party?
No, I don't. I think that... we have fairly transparent financial systems. For example, if you gave, I think it's over $30,000 to a political party, it's reported to the Electoral Commission within 2 or 3 days. There's a very strong, robust reporting system. It is very hard to give money under the table to a political party. The rules are much slacker in England, and... But we do have what I think should be extended, Jim, is quite a large proportion of state funding of political parties. It's not as extensive as in Australia, but both Labor and National, for example, were given $1 million by the state, by the Electoral Commission, to pay for electronic broadcasting. And that was quite transparent, and the Greens got so much less and New Zealand First got so much less.
Yeah.
I'd like to see more of that, because if you're relying on big donations, as the British political parties are, then you're at least vulnerable to the accusation of corruption, even if corruption doesn't occur.
It doesn't have to be dinner at Government House either, does it? It can be meeting out for drinks and or coffee in the Coro Club or at the corporate box at the rugby or at the races or anywhere. I mean, you could, you know, you don't have to actually have the formal dinner to be open to that kind of influence anyway.
No, you don't. But, of course, in New Zealand, we're a much smaller and more intimate society. So if somebody wants to rub shoulders with a leader, then it's actually not difficult to do that. I mean, it's a reasonably safe society, so party leaders can, you know, walk around at the big day out or whatever without too much fear. That's not the case in Britain.
Yeah, OK, so there is a difference. We're reassured. Thank you, Mike Williams, on the panel with Rosemary and Steve and Hewitt standing by now with the news headlines.